The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. My guest this week is Tom Zohar, whose love for stories about powerful women led him to movies like Death Becomes Her and The Joy Luck Club, and whose hippie parents brought him to musicals like Hair. A common thread through a lot of Tom's favorite media is characters who are completely and totally unrepressed. But self-repression was an issue he had to deal with as a teenager when he recloseted himself and became increasingly shy about his accent. Theater is what helped him reclaim his voice, but not after the family fled the country to prevent him being conscripted into the Israeli army. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook, where I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. This week, you can look forward to some fun clips from Death Becomes Her. And speaking of videos, check out my YouTube series Culture Cruise, where I do a deep dive into LGBTQ milestones in entertainment that changed the world. I just posted a new video that combines footage from 50 years of documentaries to reconstruct the history of New York's ballroom, voguing, and drag ball scene. You can find it by searching YouTube for Culture Cruise. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly livestream on August 1st at 11 a.m. Pacific. It's a nice, relaxing time to just hang out and chat. There's a link at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Also, if you're looking for more queer podcasts, check out my narrative comedy shows Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends for an escape into a world of fantasy with drag queens playing Dungeons & Dragons. You can subscribe to both shows at queensofadventure.com or search your favorite podcast app. Now, here's Tom. Well, this week I'm speaking with Tom Zohar, an actor in San Diego. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, my pleasure. Hello.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
So choosing one, of course, is always hard, but the one thing that I always go back to because it shaped so much of my childhood is the movie Death Becomes Her.
Fantastic. So this was a movie that was always too scary for me to watch. So sell me on Death Becomes Her.
So first of all, you saying that kind of signifies to me that we're very different people, which is great. So Death Becomes Her never scared me. It fascinated me more than anything else. So I would say right away that I wasn't scared of it. I was more fascinated by the story and the special effects and just the way that it kind of tells a story of these people trying to maintain kind of immortality and finding out that that's actually a terrible idea in action was fascinating to me. But the movie came out in 1992. I did not see it in theaters. I was way too young. I think I was about 8 years old. I think I saw the movie maybe a year or a couple of years later when it was on TV. And full disclosure, I was born in Israel. I fled when I was 16 to avoid being drafted into the IDF. That's a story for another day.
Sure.
But so I already at that point had a pretty good grasp of like American, because the American movies were being shown in Israel at that time, and I had a pretty good grasp of American culture and everything, but not as good as a grasp as someone might have who actually grew up in the United States. So one of the funny things about watching movies like Death Becomes Her for me as a kid was that it fed into my idea of what American culture was as a whole. Because another piece of entertainment that fed a lot into my idea of what American culture was when I was a kid was Full House, the series.
Great.
Because I remember watching it as a child and thinking that every American lived in a huge house on a hillside with like a lot of family members in the same home, and I didn't realize that it was unusual.
I mean, any really sitcom from that era, you'd be like, wow, Americans have so much.
Oh yeah, so it's really funny to watch that kind of stuff when you were not born in America, because you really do think, oh my god, so everyone lives in San Francisco, which is this mythical place in this big, which to me looked like a kind of manor with a bunch of men in the same household. But so anyway, when I watched Death Becomes Her, that was one of the keys I had to American culture. And when I think back on it now, it actually is pretty accurate considering the way that things are in entertainment. And because it's a huge send-up of Hollywood and kind of beauty culture in general.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that really kind of fed me in the way that it kind of taught me as a child what beauty culture and kind of the superficial culture of beauty in Hollywood can become when it gets really ugly.
Was that like relatable to you? Like, was that something that you were like, at the time that you first saw it, you were like, oh, it's a comment on this culture? Or were you just like, I don't know, it's also a very entertaining film. So was it more just that?
I don't know that I related to it, but visually and in terms of just there was a weird fascination, I guess, with seeing these really powerful, beautiful people being vicious to each other, which even as a child of like 9 or 10, I found really entertaining. And I don't even know, and maybe you can help me find the root of what really was it was that as a 10-year-old I found interesting about it.
Growing up in Israel in the 80s and 90s, and a story about powerful people being vicious to each other. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what the connection
there could be. Some kind of weird socio-political, I don't know. But at the time, obviously, I wasn't thinking about that. I can say that just viscerally, even without analyzing it as a kid, I just found it really fabulous. And I loved the way that they looked. And even from an early childhood, I found really beautiful, powerful women to be kind of interesting in a way that I couldn't really point a finger to why or how exactly. Because my fascination with really great, powerful actresses started in my lizard brain before I could even really figure out what it all meant. So that was a big part of it, because even at the time, I already was familiar with Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep. And a lot of that comes from my parents, because my parents were big movie fans from way before I was even born. And I remember in my house, we weren't really sheltered or shielded from things that a lot of other kids would be shielded from, by which I mean my parents didn't really try to shield us from watching anything that was in any way risque. They explained it to us, yeah, and we weren't like being left alone to watch things that would be disturbing, but sex scenes and like things that some kids would be would not be allowed to watch. We really didn't grow up in a household like that. So I was familiar with certain actors and actresses from an early age just because my parents really loved them. Mm-hmm. So I know that Meryl Streep in my household was definitely a name that I was familiar with. Goldie Hawn, my mom kind of idolized. She sort of, I remember in my mom's like icons in terms of like aesthetic and beauty when my mom was younger in like the 70s were mainly Mia Farrow and Goldie Hawn, and I remember that very strongly even as a kid. So I was familiar with them even as a child, so seeing them both in a movie even when I was 8 or 9 or 10 was entertaining to me. And my parents really loved the movie, so when I saw it the first time on TV, I didn't find it scary. I just found it really fun. And I can't say by any means that I understood all the kind of themes that go into it, but I just kind of found it really entertaining. And then the way that it presents men, because that movie presents men as sort of like playthings almost. The movie, interestingly enough, is mostly... there is a big, strong sense of the female gaze in it, which is that men in a lot of scenes in it are kind of presented as like the beautiful thing that you're supposed to look at, but that are not necessarily very smart. The movie has a lot of great examples of the himbo, which lately has become kind of a controversial topic online. But if you're looking for a himbo, look no further than Liesl's manservants in her big old mansion, because that was my first... I think, view of like, oh, men can also just be these beautiful things that lurk around and that you tell them what to do. And they're not the powerful creatures in this movie at all. Like, the men don't hold the power in this movie. And that kind of was interesting to me as a child, too.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, like, I guess the one agent of, like, male heterosexuality is Bruce Willis's character.
Yeah, and he's a simp.
Yeah, he's there, he's cute, and he's not exactly the protagonist.
No, he's not at all, and actually they both use him, and in the end of the movie, I mean, spoiler alert, not that we can really say that at this point, but he does come out quote-unquote on top, but even that's kind of shown as something that's sort of ridiculed by the two women. So it's just interesting, it's a whole movie where the men are either kind of... weaker, and I hate to use those terms because Bruce Willis does have a really interesting character arc in the movie also, but he's not the focus at all.
Did you see it like, was it sort of aspirational? Like, I want to be those women. Like, they're so cool. Yeah. They're so powerful.
I think so. Looking back on it, I would say definitely there was a part of it for me because I did, and obviously at the time I didn't realize it, But one way that I can kind of point back to the way that you're probably right about that is that I do remember for a long time, because I watched that movie over and over again, because eventually we got it on video, and I watched it over and over again, and I started quoting a lot of the things that the women say in it. Like, I was fascinated with saying, "You pushed me down the stairs." That's one of the things that Meryl Streep says in it. So I would quote the women. I would kind of pretend to be them a little bit, like the way that they walked and talked. So I can see how that was definitely an influence for me growing up. There was probably something aspirational about it.
There's also so many, you know, like, I guess with any Meryl movie, so many acting choices, but like real big ones in that one.
Yeah, they're outlandish. I mean, and the thing is, like, obviously, because they're both amazing, it's all very grounded and in whatever reality the movie belongs in, but none of it appears to be, like, they're not overdoing anything, but it's a broad, dark comedy, and the style that both the main women, but all the actors in the movie, including Isabella Rossellini, it's very broad, it's very theatrical. Which is also very appealing to a kid, I think, because, at least for me as a kid, because it's almost a cartoon. That's the other reason why I didn't really find the movie scary, is because in a lot of ways it's very cartoony. A lot of the pain that they inflict on each other is straight out of Looney Tunes.
That's true, yeah. It's so ridiculous and fantastic, like absurd, that, I don't know, I think for me that was part of the fear. It's the same reason that I, like, am made uncomfortable by Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where there's sort of a breaking of what familiar rules I can understand about how the world works. And so I was just having a conversation with somebody else about this. Like, it made me feel, do you know the cartoon Duck Amuck? It's the Daffy Duck one.
Yeah.
Where he's like erased. Like, there was this time, I think, in my media consumption where that eraser just sort of like haunted me. The idea of like the rules of the universe could just be like completely changed and out of your control, and the predictable way that things work means nothing. And
that's really interesting, actually. And it points, I have to say, it points to the fact that you were a much more contemplative child than I was. By which I mean, I'm not implying by any means that I didn't have any level of introspect, because I certainly did. But I tended to be very visual. And a lot of the movies, TV shows, even animated movies that I loved as a kid, I kind of looked at them very visually. So I didn't really consider any of those themes when I was watching Death Becomes Her. But what's funny is, you mentioned Who Frames Roger Rabbit, and I for years couldn't watch that movie because something about Judge Doom scared me too much. And again, it was very visual. There's something about the way that he looked where it traumatized me, so I didn't watch the entire movie of Who Framed Roger Rabbit until a little later in life.
Same for me, yeah. And it was absolutely, it was 100% Judge Doom. I don't know about 100%. It was also just the fact that, like, I didn't get how the world worked, but particularly around the end, this is actually, now that I'm thinking about it, particularly around the end where the line between a real person and a tune seems to be mutable.
Yeah.
That freaked me the fuck out. And
and then do you remember there's the image of, because this one haunted me the most, the image where Judge Doom takes his sunglasses off and his eyes go all crazy. Do you remember that?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
I couldn't watch it. It scared me too much. Yeah. So that did scare me. That did scare me as a kid. But for some reason, Death Becomes Her didn't. Go figure.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think, you know, it's the power of those fantastic, powerful women.
Yeah, I think so. Well, and the other thing about the film that I think as a kid kind of fascinated me, because I was from a very young age kind of really intrigued and fascinated with pretty much all aspects of sex. I don't know if it's because my parents didn't really shield me from it. So instead of becoming fascinated with it in this weird, like, kind of like, this is wrong kind of way, I was just fascinated with finding out about how it all worked. And this is, I'm talking like pre-pubescent. So like, this didn't hold any kind of like, it wasn't titillating. I was just fascinated with it on an almost kind of like intellectual level. Mm. And Death Becomes Her has a lot of kind of sexual intrigue in it. A lot of jokes, and it has to do with like sex and how you use sex to manipulate people. And I really feel in a weird way, like as a child, it sort of fascinated me too, to see adults behave so adult in a way that is sort of almost like they treat each other like playthings. And I think that was also interesting to me as a kid. Also, just the whole thing again with, like, if you look at Liesel, the character that Isabella Rossellini plays, who's like this powerful kind of like sorceress who lives in this big mansion and she wears next to nothing. And I think watching her and the people around her are all kind of scantily clad. Something about it as a kid, I was like, oh, that's really visually appealing. And I don't really understand it completely, but I definitely want to keep looking at it.
You're like, oh, is this what it is to be a grown up?
Yeah, kind of. Yes, exactly. And like, can I be like this when I'm a grown up? Can I be Isabella Rossellini and be surrounded by manservants in like essentially loincloths? It was just interesting. I think I found it very fascinating, even in a way that I couldn't quite really articulate as a kid. I just wanted to see it.
Were you aware at that point of being queer?
Yes. What's weird is, like, I remember, this is very specific situation, because I remember like I said, I grew up in Israel, and flying from Israel to Europe is really easy. It's like a 3-hour flight. So where people in America perhaps would take like a trip to like Mexico, or I don't know, like I'm trying to think of something that's easy to get to. Like flying from Israel to Paris is like flying from San Diego to Las Vegas. It's essentially the same kind of level of difficulty, and it takes about the same amount of time. So that is all to say that when I was a kid, we used to take trips to Europe. And I remember at one point we stayed at this hotel where they did, and I'm talking when I was maybe 6 or 7, maybe even a little bit younger. We stayed at this hotel, and I remember there was a theater in the hotel where they did like these kind of hokey little like cruise ship kind type shows. And I remember even at that point watching the show, and there was one of the performers who also worked at the hotel, and he was a very handsome guy, and I was fascinated with him. And at the time, I didn't know that I was supposed to make it any kind of a secret. So I just kept telling my parents that I loved him, and I don't have a lot of really strong memories from my childhood, but I remember certain things very strongly, and I remember him, and I remember that, because my parents at the time were just kind of like, okay, and they shrugged their shoulders and kind of had me, like, talk to him, and I was way too shy, and I just remember being fascinated with this guy. So that's one of my early memories as a kid of knowing that I was really, really fascinated with men. So I would really date it back to when I was like 6 or 7, honestly. And maybe possibly even before that I had some inkling, but I remember again as a kid just being really interested in men and not knowing at first that it was something that was supposed to be weird or wrong. And again, I attributed a lot to the fact that I grew up in a household where things were pretty open. My parents were hippies when they met. Everything was pretty, like, they were very liberal. This is a household where I grew up hearing about gay people. My parents, before I was born, when they were young, lived in an apartment next door to a gay couple, and I heard a lot of stories about them because my parents really loved them and had a lot of really funny stories about them because they were very dramatic. But again, this was at a time when, we're talking when my parents, like, were young and lived next door to this gay couple. This was probably, like, late 70s, early 80s. So this is, again, points to the fact that I grew up in a household where these things were acceptable. Now, mind you, by no means did I feel like I was supposed to go around kind of screaming that I was gay. I didn't really understand what it meant. But I grew up kind of being aware of that being a thing. Now, of course, because of the culture that we all lived in the world at that time, I also was kind of vaguely aware of what AIDS was. Of course, as a kid, I didn't really completely understand it, but I also, because of society, made a connection between homosexuality and this terrible disease. So I also understood that there were dangers involved in it. But as a kid, I didn't really have the intellectual power to really understand any of that. But so that's all to say that, yes, I think I was aware of being gay at a pretty early point.
Okay. What did that mean, like, in larger society, like in the context of being in Israel? Like, what was the attitude more commonly just out in the world?
Well, it's interesting. It's kind of funny. I didn't think that I would delve into Israel so much, but I'm kind of glad we are. It's funny because I don't talk about being from there a lot A, because I kind of fled, which is fine. I mean, I'm not a fugitive, but it's not something that comes up a lot because I kind of put it behind me. But also because it just doesn't come up a lot because at this point, I've assimilated myself so much that I kind of forget about it most of the time unless I really think about it. But one of the things I would say about growing up in Israel, which is interesting and I think people find surprising, is that the one thing I can point to that's very progressive is that at least in terms of my experience with it, homosexuality wasn't really something that was seen as quite as abhorrent as maybe it did or even does even now in some areas of the United States. I remember growing up as a teenager and seeing guys kiss at the hallways of my high school at the time. And of course, you know, kids will be kids. So it's not like people didn't insult each other. Kids didn't insult each other by calling each other gay and stuff like that. And by no means am I trying to say that everyone finds it acceptable. But it wasn't a big deal. I don't remember being really scared by it. Yes, when I was a preteen and then a teenager, I kind of got to the point where I was in the closet for a while because it just seems like the right thing to do because things are not that different, or I should say things were not that different. But at least when I was a kid, it didn't really seem like something that dangerous because in Israel, I don't know, it just seems like that wasn't an issue that people were too concerned about. And if you look at things in terms of cinema, even now, a lot of the really great movies that are LGBTQ themed come from Israel. It's interesting. If you do a search, you'll find that a lot of really great movies about being gay come out of there. So I'm not saying by any means that things are perfect, but I just mean that I just know that growing up, it was pretty clear to me that that wasn't something I had to be scared of. But that all being said, yes, when I grew up to be a teenager, I did end up being in the closet until I was, I want to say, 16 or 17.
Well, I was going to ask, like, did you have other gay people or queer people in your life? Like, did you, like, a gay straight alliance or anything like that?
No. I knew of people from my extended family who were gay. My aunt growing up had female lovers and subsequently now is divorced from her husband and living with a woman. But that was kind of like the open secret in our family. So it's not like we really super talked about it except like gossip. I knew about my family, my parents telling me stories about the people they knew when they were young. And when I was a kid, I had a friend in high school who, you know, we did some very, very tame, boring experimenting. So I guess maybe that could be something I could point to, but not really personally, no.
Having that fandom for powerful women, and it sounds like a taste, even if you didn't recognize this at the time, for like queer media and like stuff that other gays like, who were you able to share that affection for that kind of entertainment
with? Oh, great question. My mom. Definitely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I grew up very close to my mom. And I mean, my dad was you know, it's not like I wasn't in good terms with him also, but I grew up very much like a mama's boy. Me and my mom used to watch movies together a lot when I was growing up as a kid. We watched a lot of movies that would be considered to be chick flicks at this point. So it's funny. I remember also growing up, they used to play movies from China. I don't even know why, but like there was a channel that played really great Chinese movies, and I remember me and my mom would sit down in the afternoon sometimes and watch these great, kind of in some ways very melodramatic, very highly emotional movies from China. This is, by the way, when I became very familiar with the actress Li Gong, who I'm kind of happy is now still, she was one of the most prolific actors to come out of China at the time, I think. And I remember me and my mom kind of loved her. But then, so we started watching a lot of movies during the daytime when I came home together that, you know, my dad wouldn't necessarily want to watch or my sister, who was kind of more of a tomboy, wouldn't want to watch. So I shared a lot of that appreciation with my mom. My mom taught me a lot about great movies that she loved growing up and that she loved when she was young. And we kind of shared that love together. So a lot of it came from her and I shared most of it with her.
What were, like, if you're thinking back, like, are there any particular movies that you're like, this was our thing, or like, this is a movie that I like have to go back to every now and then, like, because it just was meaningful to you?
Well, there's unfortunately, there were so many that there's not a ton of specifics. I would say that one of the big ones for us when we watched it was, because I remember as a kid, we watched Joy Luck Club at some point, mm-hmm. and we were both very affected by it. And certainly, I can't claim any kind of ownership over any part of that story, except for the fact that watching, again, it's a story about women kind of reclaiming their power, which I don't know if it came from growing up, kind of like seeing my mom be... Because my mom and my dad didn't have a great relationship when I was growing up. Subsequently, they divorced. They fought a lot when I was a kid. And watching her be strong, I guess, possibly had something to do with it. But I just had this weird visceral appreciation for watching stories about women overcoming adversity, finding their strength. And I can't really pinpoint to one specific reason why I grew up being so fascinated with it, but that stayed with me forever. Like, that's still something that I gravitate to more than anything else. But so I would say, if I had to think of specific ones besides, you know, Death Becomes Her, I remember we watched the Bridges of Madison County, which, why would you have a kid watch that movie? But we watched it, and I enjoyed it. And again, there wasn't a lot of taboo, kind of like with anything that has to do with sex and stuff. So I don't know, we were really gravitating towards, again, things that would be considered chick flicks by anyone else, but to me were just really great stories about women with great actresses. But Joy Luck Club was a big one for me. It's funny because I would say that kind of genre of film encapsulates perfectly the kind of movies that I was really gravitating towards when I was growing up and kind of figuring out what my taste was when it comes to entertainment.
Were you thinking about being an actor then?
Yeah, but in a kind of very kind of like, this is a fantasy that I don't know could come true kind of way. I remember when I was a child, we would visit my grandparents, and they had this one doorway that had this really heavy curtain over it, and I would pretend that I was going through the curtain to accept my Oscar. So I remember doing that when I was a kid. But everything, all my aspirations, again, all had to do with wanting to be an actress, and I didn't really understand what it was. I didn't really care about the guys in the movies, so it's interesting. Like, a lot of my fantasy life had to do with wanting to be a glamorous actress and accepting an Oscar while wearing a great dress. I don't know. And also, I remember as a kid, I would watch cartoons, and I would watch the women in the cartoons, and I remember I would really wish that I could put on, like, a skirt and, like, run around, and I didn't quite get to do any of that because I didn't have access to any of that stuff, but I don't know, it had a big effect on me.
Well, what was the effect? Like, where did you see yourself going in I guess, in life?
I wasn't sure. It's interesting. I don't know that I really knew at the time. And then when I was growing up, there was a long period of time where I thought that I wanted to be an animator because I became really, really kind of obsessed with animation, animated movies. And I guess that was like a step for me to be like, well, I guess that's one way that I could be an actor. And I worked on that for a long time. And then I didn't really get into actually doing any kind of performing until we moved to the United States. And then I auditioned for a show because I went to community college here. Because at the time, I didn't even really graduate high school because my parents moved me before I graduated high school because they were just like, oh my God, we can't have you drafted.
Did the whole family like pick up and move?
Well, it's my immediate family. So it's really just four people. Just me, my sister, my mom, and my dad. And we knew people in Arizona, I think. So that what my dad kind of, and I don't, a lot of this is kind of vague to me because I was a kid. I didn't really have anything to do with any of the planning, but I just remember at the time my parents being like, we need to get him out of here. And so we did. And now I'm very thankful for it because I would want nothing to do with any of that. But yeah, they moved us to the United States. I started going to community college here. Subsequently, Israel took away my Israeli passport because they punish you if you don't go, you know, if you don't get drafted, you get punished. So, and I couldn't go back for a long time, which is fine. But so they moved us here. And I started going to community college here, and I auditioned for a play, and I got in. And that's kind of when that all started. I started taking classes, but That all kind of happened. It almost felt like I didn't realize I really wanted to do it until I stumbled on it. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is what I've been wanting to do forever, but I didn't really think about it.
Now, we were chatting earlier on Twitter. You mentioned hair as also being very formative for you.
Yeah. Yes.
How did that enter your life, and what was your impression of it?
Well, again, my parents were hippies when they were young, and they have been obsessed with the musical Hair since before I was born. And this also comes from the fact that for some reason, I can't point to why, because I'm sure there are people out there who would know why, but the musical Hair was a huge deal in Israel. I want to say probably in the 70s, around the time when it became popular, other places as well. I mean, the musical became an international sensation at that time also, but anyway, it was a huge deal in Israel. And I remember when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old, this is kind of vague, they did a production of it in Israel that my parents took me to see. It's funny because they warned me at the time. They didn't warn me, but they explained to me and my sister, you know, this is kind of an adult musical. There's going to be a point in it where people are going to be naked on stage. And I didn't really understand what that meant exactly, but I was very much prepared for it. And I have a very, very specific early memory of after the show being like, but no one was naked at any point. And I realized later on that it's because I didn't know what pubic hair was.
Oh.
So I thought they were wearing underwear.
Ah.
It was interesting to think about because I was ready for it. And then I thought it didn't happen. And then later on, I was like, oh, no, I just didn't understand what a naked person even looked like.
Yeah.
But so I went to see it as a kid. And because I grew up on that music, I mean, I hardcore grew up on that music. My parents played the album constantly, and I'm talking the Hebrew one. So I wasn't aware of the American version until I watched the movie a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
But so I was very aware of the music, and it kind of like seeped its way into my bones and my blood. So it had a huge influence on me as a kid. And it was probably my first kind of like bit of understanding of culture that has to do with free love, with bisexuality, because a lot of themes in it, a lot of the characters in it are very openly bisexual. So that was my intro to that as a kid. I have a very also early memory when I went to see that one production when I was like 4 or 5, when at the very end they invite the audience to dance on and sing on stage with them when they sing Let the Sunshine In, which is something they do in pretty much all productions.
Mm-hmm.
But I was a tiny kid. So I remember one of the ensemble members, this big strapping shirtless guy, put me on his shoulders and danced around with me on his shoulders. And I was so excited and nervous that I couldn't do anything but just kind of like thump my feet on his chest. So I have a very vivid memory of my feet with big old white sneakers on them just thumping on his chest.
Mm.
And that's one of my earliest memories of being like, oh, a man. It's a man and I'm on his shoulders. And it's just, this is one of the things that happened to you in life where you will never forget it. So I will never forget that moment.
Mm.
So yeah, that musical had a huge influence on me. And looking on it now, there's some elements to it that we could argue are definitely problematic. I still think the score is gorgeous.
Yeah, it doesn't, like, I guess it ages like it would age. Like, it certainly,
yeah.
It's so much of its time.
Yeah.
And I do, like, I love the score as well. But if I stop to think about the words of some of the songs, I'm like, okay.
Oh my God. Well, and if, I mean, it's this musical written by two white people and they're claiming ownership of so much that now we realize they shouldn't be claiming ownership of. Now, obviously, listen, this is all good intentions. And obviously a lot of people of color were involved in it at all steps of the way. But yeah, if you look at it through the lens of today, there are some problematic elements for sure. I will never not think that the score has some of the best songs out there. I love it.
So, like, two of the things that we've talked about, Death Becomes Her and Hair, are both, like, super unrepressed. But then we also chatted briefly before this call about The Talented Mr. Ripley, which is, like, when I think about that movie, that is so much about repression to me.
It's all about repression, yeah. That's interesting. Well, to go back to, if we go back to Death Becomes Her, there are some elements of repression in it. I mean, just looking at Bruce Willis's character kind of being put upon and not knowing how to assert his, like, power and being overpowered by all these people around him. So I guess there is some element to that. Talented Mr. Ripley, I came upon later. I mean, I was in college, and that's around, like, high school and college to me was around the time when I did kind of, like, revert a little bit back into a shell. I was still kind of new-ish in America, and I was ashamed of having an accent, stupidly, so I didn't talk a lot for a long time. And then also just at that, at the point, around the point when I was maybe 15, 16, 17, which is around the time that we moved here, I kind of felt awkward. I regressed into the closet. I didn't really have a lot of friends, or really any, for a long time. When I saw The Talented Mr. Ripley, I immediately recognized a lot of myself in the main character, which, I mean, besides, you know, the murder. But, I mean, we could get into what the plot is if people don't know, but I remember that was one of the most I don't remember relating to a character as much as I related to him when I watched that movie, and it had a big effect on me that kind of like really had a huge impact when I was going through kind of my late teenhood trying to figure out who I was and how to kind of like escape this shell that I felt like I was trapped in terms of just being awkward and not being out of the closet yet and not having a lot of friends, never having had a boyfriend at that point. And I remember watching that movie and seeing this guy who's trying so hard to just be liked, and that need kind of runs away from him and becomes so toxic that it just makes him do terrible things that he does end up kind of paying for later on, but it was kind of a cautionary tale too, because, you know, you watch it and you go, well, I hope I don't become a monster like this person. But I just remember seeing those feelings of just feeling like nothing you're saying or doing is right. So that was a big impact on me. And it's also just such a flawlessly made film. And I still, to this day, really appreciate it. I still think to this day that it's probably one of the most flawlessly constructed pieces of cinema, just in terms of just the cinematography, the acting, the music. And again, even at the time watching it, I was just so fascinated with Gwyneth Paltrow and Kate Blanchett in it, because it's these glamorous, very sophisticated, very vulnerable women. So that was a big part of it also is, and the fashion is so fabulous. So I don't know, it had a big impact on me in a lot of ways, but also just because I saw a lot of the main character is something that I kind of identified with very strongly.
Well, it seems like you did find a way, out of that and to not become a monster, not just be repressed and desperate for being liked at any cost. So how did that happen? Like, how did you find yourself?
Theater. Mm-hmm. Without a doubt. So again, like I said, when I started going to college, and I auditioned for a production of Noel Coward's Hay Fever that they were doing at my school. Funny enough, it wasn't supposed to be Hay Fever. It was supposed to be something else. I can't remember what it was. But then they switched it to Hay Fever after I auditioned. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I ended up getting cast in it and getting involved in theater at school. It kind of almost immediately forced me to come out of my shell. So I was very shy until that moment when I got into theater, because all of a sudden I was surrounded with people who were very open-minded and very accepting of people who were quote-unquote different or felt like they were different. They were loud about it. They were proud about it. I started making friends. It's interesting because I remember just like as soon as I started doing theater, as soon as I started auditioning and getting into theater classes and rehearsals and stuff, the people I was surrounded by embraced me without me even having to really do anything to assert myself or be embraced. So I attribute all of that to starting to do theater. And it allowed me to find my own voice in some ways to kind of like a fault, because I kind of stopped shutting up. So for a long time, I didn't I didn't really talk a lot around my teenhood, especially when we moved here. And then when I started doing theater, you couldn't get me to shut up. So that's still a problem that I have sometimes, because once I found my voice, I couldn't put it away again.
Well, what is that like? I know this is kind of a weird question to ask. Like, what is that voice? Like, how do you describe, what do you like to talk about? Like, what is the stuff that you won't shut up about?
Oh, pretty much anything. I don't know. There's a joke amongst my husband and people I know and my friends and everything that once I feel opposed to something or someone or a topic, if I have an opposing opinion about anything, I can get a little aggressive about it. So, like, just aggressive opinions. Now, to be fair, in my late adulthood, listen to me. In my late 20s or my 30s, I learned to modulate that a little bit, and I'm a little bit more, I'm a little bit gentler now. But it's funny, once I kind of found a group that I felt comfortable with and kind of found a way to be more outspoken in my opinions and my point of view, I became a little bit aggressive, but I don't mean it in a bad way, but like, I fought for what I believed was right. And this could be pretty much anything. I mean, if I felt like I was wronged by someone, or if I, you know, someone talked about a book or a movie or a musical that they loved that I didn't like, you know, I had to learn a little later to just be maybe a little nicer about it, but I bounced way off into being very opinionated, and I'm still very opinionated, but I learned to be a little bit more like, well, it's not about being right all the time. And I also learned that a lot of times I end up not being right, or there is no right answer. So you have to just be able to kind of like meet people in the middle. But
well, I think appreciating others' perspective and not going to extremes. I mean, that is, if there's a cautionary tale about Death Becomes Her, that's probably it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's learning how to kind of compromise with what you have and be happy sometimes. But yeah, I don't know. I still, at this point, have a lot of moments in time where the people I'm closest to would kind of look at me and go, you're having a moment, and you obviously feel very strongly about this. Let's revisit this when you don't feel very strongly about this. But I don't know. It's funny, like, I can pinpoint to before I did theater and after I did theater. For some reason, theater kind of taught me to be like, no, this is how I feel about this, and you're going to listen to me. And I think it was just me bouncing back from feeling like I didn't have a voice for a long time, just because I was embarrassed and felt like I didn't have any valuable thing to contribute. And the need to be liked is something that I feel like will always be with me, and I still battle with it sometimes in terms of, like, my own mental health things, where I can certainly spiral sometimes if I feel like, you know, I'm definitely one of those people, and I know that this is something a lot of people can identify with, where my brain will kind of just decide, based on sometimes nothing, that someone doesn't like me or that people don't like me to have me around. And that's something that I grew up with, and, you know, I had to deal with, not just growing up, but even later in life, I still have to deal with sometimes. So that's another thing where theater helped me kind of be better at saying to my inner voice, well, no, you know, I'm valuable, and what I have to say is valuable, and I have these skills and these talents. And so that helped a lot, I would say, for sure.
Well, so tell me about the acting that you're doing now. Like, what kind of shows are you in? Where can people, like, go see you once we are back to going to see theater?
Well, I started doing theater in San Diego professionally, I want to say around 2004 or 2005. So I didn't start that early, but then again, I wasn't here that early. So I had to kind of start a lot of things a little bit later in life. And I started working professionally kind of all over the place here. I ended up moving to New York for a few years to pursue it there. And I wouldn't say, quote unquote, it didn't work out, as much as I just found out that that was not something I was having a good time doing, because I missed being able to tell the stories that I wanted to tell with the people that I enjoyed working with. And when I moved to New York, it became more of kind of this, like, for lack of better terms, it felt a little bit more like a war that you had to win. And I didn't have the bloodlust for it the way that a lot of my friends who moved there at the same time that I did. And a lot of them became very successful, and I'm very happy for them, but I ended up coming back. I got married and came back to San Diego. So in terms of where you can find me, it depends. I used to do it a lot more. I ended up getting a big boy day job, and now my schedule doesn't allow me to do it as much as I used to, but I still do like one or two shows a year. If you follow me on the social medias, I do talk about it. I did very recently do not a Zoom play, but it's a play that we did. We did a play reading with a theater company that I've worked with before, that a friend of mine runs here in San Diego. We did a play called The Dazzle by Richard Greenberg. And we did a reading of it that was social distance reading. So they filmed it, but none of us came in contact with each other. But it was like a Zoom thing because we didn't do it on computers. So that's the most recent thing I did. The most recent like play I did in real life before things went a little crazy was a production of Significant Other here in San Diego. Mm-hmm. At the Diversionary Theater, which I've worked at a lot. So I can't pinpoint to one specific thing. I don't have any projects that I can pinpoint coming up in the future, because who knows what's going to happen, and it's in complete chaos right now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just kind of started working all over the place in terms of the San Diego theater community, and most of my friends are still from that world. So interestingly enough, I ended up, I mean, I don't know that I would classify myself as a theater kid by any means, because I started a little late, but most of my close friendships and my associations with people came from that world.
Do you have a dream show that you've always wanted to do?
Well, I've always wanted to do Angels in America. They did it recently in San Diego. I did not get to do it, which is fine, because the production was wonderful and the person who played Lewis was great. So, like, I by no means would say that they missed a chance of not working with me. Mm-hmm. So that's the big one that I've always been like, oh, I'd love to tackle that one day. There are a couple musicals that I would love to do. I'd love someone to do Merrily We Roll Along Here. I'd love to do that, but that's, you know, that's a cursed piece of theater, and that's a hard one. I still haven't gotten a chance to play Model and Fiddler, and that's unfortunate. I feel like I was born to play it. I don't know how that eluded me. And pretty much anything Sondheim. I've done a few Sondheim shows before. I'd love to do more. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for me. I usually kind of keep things open. I try to just find out about things as they're happening. So I don't have a lot of really, like, bucket list things that I would really love to do before I die, because I just try to keep myself a little bit more open to whatever goes on. Oh, falsettos. I'd love to do falsettos at some point.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's a really...
By William Finn.
It sounds like a lot of the shows that you're talking about are shows that are maybe a bit melancholy.
Yeah. I tend to go for more of the cerebral... I'm not trying to, like, sound all smarty-schmarty here, but I tend to go for more of the cerebral kind of, like, musicals that would read more like a play than the big old dancey musicals, which doesn't mean that I don't love them. I love big dancey musicals, but like, I can't really dance. So most of the things I end up being cast in are the musicals that are a little bit more cerebral, more like smaller casts. So yeah, those are usually the ones that I gravitate towards more than anything else. Same with movie musicals. Like, one of my favorite movie musicals of all time is The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which is this very interesting French musical from the 60s that I feel like now people are starting to know about it a little bit more. But so I tend to go for more for, like, the more niche and unusual. And I hate, again, saying that makes me sound so pretentious, but I don't mean it that way. I just mean that that's usually the stuff that I gravitate to more than anything else.
You know, you mentioned that theater initially helped you find your voice and become more outspoken, and now you've done that. It's done that for you. What does theater do for you now?
Let me see how I can explain this. I've always been, just to kind of like try to put this into terms, I've always been a little bit iffy about doing a one-person show, for the reason that most of my favorite moments of being on stage are the moments of connection with someone else. That's what feeds me the most. So what theater does for me now is I think it offers people a way to connect, where it forces you to connect to a story or people or a person and consider their point of view, or perhaps even just a different point of view you didn't think about before, because you have to because you're sitting down and you're watching this story being told in front of you. And I mean, you can leave, but it's not ideal. You can't really check your phone. Again, you can, but you shouldn't. So unlike TV, film, or even books or anything else, you're an active participator in something that's happening in front of you live. And whether I'm an audience member or I'm performing, it feels like this really active way of connecting with someone in an immediate and very deep level. And it's sometimes in a way that you can't even like really explain because there's something almost metaphysical about it. So I think for me, it's just, it offers connection. It just offers an immediate way to connect.
Mm. Boy, oh boy, it's kind of like you could use right now.
Well, yeah. And it's kind of like the whole thing of like, even if you look at, this is just one specific example, and by no means do I imply that Mike Pence became better because he went to see Hamilton, but it's a great example of like, this is a person who had to sit down and watch a 2.5-3 hour show about something that had ideas in it that perhaps oppose, you know, the ideas that he perhaps would apply his life to on a regular basis. And this is just one example where it's like, sometimes people go to see a play or a musical, and you're just kind of forced to reckon with something that you may have not thought about or agreed with before, and you really have to consider it. And I feel like theater is the art form that still is the most powerful when it comes to kind of, for lack of a better word, forcing people to reconcile with things they may have not been comfortable thinking about before. And I don't know that there's another medium that does that in such a powerful way, because everything else you can turn off or you can leave. And with theater, it's almost like you're a captive to someone else's story. And I think it's really valuable, and I hope we're not going to lose it, because obviously right now everything is kind of up in the air in terms of what's going to happen with theater. And luckily, I think there's a lot of people out there who are finding great ways to keep it alive. This is one of the things, though, that has made the whole Zoom play movement be kind of like, I don't know, I have a love-hate relationship with it. When it's done well, it is certainly interesting. And I've seen a few Zoom plays that were done well and were interesting to watch. But it's not theater. You know, because again, it's essentially something you're watching. You're not an active participator, and you can turn it off at any point. So it doesn't really replace it. And I don't know that anything does. And that's the scary thing about where we are now, is that for theater to be theater, you have to have a group of people who are all in the same space together experiencing something. So it's, you know, it's a necessary component. And right now we can't have the component. So it's a little scary, but
yeah, I'm really looking forward to the time when we can go back into those, like, darkened rooms where we're all just staring at a story unfolding in front of us.
I know. And I'm a hopeful person by nature, so I do think that we'll find a way to get back to it. But it's interesting, being part of the theater community here, I have kind of an inside view of how all these... Because if you look at... People talk a lot about Broadway because it's this big beacon of mainstream theater entertainment, and we can look at it as kind of like the litmus test of what's being done and not done in the theater industry in terms of how, you know, how they're being safe, the closures, when things are opening up again. But I would urge people to also kind of like do a little bit more research about the smaller theater companies, the regional theater companies around the country, because it gives you an even stronger idea of what people are trying to do to stay alive during this time. Because being in San Diego and being friends with a lot of people who are deeply involved in the theater community here, I have an inside view of like the smaller theater communities and how they're dealing with it. And it can be a little bit scary, but it's also very inspiring to see all the different ways that they're trying to stay relevant and trying to make revenue during this time. Because, boy, it's not easy. Like, you can't do a gala. You can't really do readings. So all these theater companies keep trying to do digital content. And you're seeing all these, like, businesses that are not used to churning out digital content, trying to make it work. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And, yoy, it's a lot. But I'm hopeful that we'll get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. We, you know, this is maybe a weird thing to compare it to, but, like, in Death Becomes Her, I feel like there's a sort of immortality to the need to tell stories.
Yeah.
That, you know, as it endures supernaturally.
Well, and then, for better or worse, those two women live to tell the tale, and they will not be able to they won't die, so they're kind of stuck. That's another thing about it, is that it's about people who are, they're immortal, so all they have is each other, and all they can do is continue moving forward and telling their story, so... I guess in a way it's kind of I guess Death Becomes Her in a way as a story about hope and perseverance.
Inspirational and also cautionary.
I know. It's funny, we didn't really even delve into the movie in depth, I just realized, because I babble so much.
I'm going to just trust that people at this point are familiar enough with Death Becomes Her that we don't need to go do like a plot summary.
And, oh, and then I remember, you know, it's funny, like, I didn't even think about this. Like, the whole movie starts with a really outlandish, it's got a show tune. It starts with a musical number.
Lady Bird. Is it Lady Bird or Songbird?
Not Lady. Yes. No, Sweet Bird of Youth. Although now I want a Lady Bird musical.
Lady Bird
I
the
wish
musical.
Someone
yes.
would do that. If anyone's listening, when COVID is over, Janine Tesori, if you're listening, it's time for a Lady Bird musical. But no, so that's another thing, because I was obsessed with that musical number and I learned all the choreography and I memorized the song and everything. So that's another thing I can pinpoint to being like, oh yeah, stage and singing and acting. And at the time I thought it was fabulous. I still think it's fabulous, but at the time it completely escaped me that it was supposed to be bad. Mm-hmm. Like I remember watching it and not really even understanding why the audience members are leaving.
Yeah,
like,
it's not bad. It's actually pretty good.
It's not. Well, I think the whole comment is that Sweet Bird of Youth should not be a disco musical, but also fuck that. Like I was really into it.
Yeah.
I'm still into it.
I am looking forward to when we can all go back to the theater. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Death Becomes Her the musical.
Oh my God. And you know what? Lady Bird the musical, now that you mentioned it, I could play either one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I could be Timothée Chalamet or, what's his name?
The other one.
The other one. Oh God, I hope he's not listening. I'm so sorry. I don't mean to imply that Timothée is more important than you. I'm looking it up right now because I feel like I should know his name. Oh yeah, Lucas Hedges.
That's the one.
Yes, I could be either one of them. So I'm to anyone who's doing the Lady Bird musical when COVID is over, I'm ready at a moment's notice.
Perfect. Available. Tom, thank you so much for joining me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for listening to me babble. I hope I didn't babble too much because I tend to.
No, not at all. The babbling is good. We like the babbling.
Good. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Tom for joining me. On the topic of powerful female roles, and Isabella Rossellini in particular, my recommendation this week is for a project that she did about 10 years ago called Green Porno. In this series of short videos, Rossellini slips into stylized animal costumes to explain and demonstrate the methods by which species have sex. She also researches, writes, and directs the videos, which graphically depict her reenacting the mating habits of dragonflies, snails, whales, starfish, and many, many more, with the help of puppets and props. The videos themselves are truly bizarre and hypnotic, beautifully shot with lots of lush color and, of course, featuring Rossellini's wonderfully soothing voice. It's sort of like Sesame Street sex ed for adults, educational, sure, dreamlike, and strange, with a celebrity presence that's maybe the most baffling detail of all. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Patreon backers get rewards like stickers in the mail and postcards, a copy of my book Defining Marriage, and also exclusive access to the Patreon-only podcast, Cozy Pants. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get access to those benefits. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And join us for the next live stream on August 1st at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link pinned to the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Check out my YouTube series Culture Cruise for detailed explorations of queer milestones from TV and film. And subscribe to my other podcasts, Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two comedy adventure shows featuring drag queens playing D&D. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin McLeod of Incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.